Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Good morning. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Genko, and I'm ordained and living in Seattle. So, the topic this morning for the talk is called No Shortage, No Shortage. And this came to me, I was thinking about a chapter in the book of Exodus, so this is a little bit different from a Buddhist text, but chapter 16 is a wonderful chapter that I remember from when I was a child hearing it. It's the story of God's attempt to build trust with the Israelites when they left Egypt. They came into the desert with a real scarcity mentality, having been slaves in Egypt. They just didn't trust much of anything or anybody. And when God had spoken to Moses and said, I want you to lead the Israelites out of Egypt, he said, they're not going to trust me. You know, I'm not the one who can lead them out. He says, they can trust you because I'm going to be guiding you. And he said, why should I trust you? You know, you let us be slaves in Egypt. Why should we trust you? And so this chapter 16 is a really wonderful one because it's how God is offering them quail in the evening to eat and then manna, this bread-like substance, in the morning to eat and saying, just gather as much as you need for the people in your tent for today. And then don't try to hoard it. You don't need to hoard it. I'll be bringing it back every day. But if you hoard it, it will spoil. And of course, that's what happened. And so they kind of gradually began to believe that they would be provided for each day. And then, of course, when it came to the Sabbath, God said, you need to gather twice as much because I'm not going to provide anything for you on the Sabbath. I don't want you out there running around looking for food on the Sabbath. I want you to rest. Nobody believed that the first time either, so they just got enough for the day, and then they went out the next day, and of course there was nothing there to get on the Sabbath. So it took a lot of, it's kind of fun to read because God gets irritated with them. These are really annoying people. They don't pay attention to me when I tell them to do something. And, you know, if you remember the story, it took 40 years of wandering in the wilderness for them to move from having that scarcity mentality to an abundance mentality, this more spacious quality that says, you know, things may not look good right now, it may look a little tight, a little difficult right now, but things are going to unfold. I can trust that things will unfold eventually the way they should, and just kind of relax about it. But it took two generations, 40 years, to kind of work through that. So it's not an easy thing to do, to move from this scarcity mentality to an abundance mentality and have some gratitude. They had some trust in God, which is essentially gratitude for his caring for them. When I was a child, I found that story very comforting, that things would work out all right. And we don't necessarily say we trust in God, but we trust that the universe is going to unfold the way it needs to, that if we hold up our end of the bargain, things will unfold the way they need to. That's, of course, what karma is, the cause and effect, that if we act in a certain way, eventually things are going to unfold that way. It's important to remember that, too, because, like, right now, I think all of us have a sense of anxiety about how the world is unfolding. this fear around flooding and other natural disasters, fear about the political situation and how that may unfold. And it creates a lot of anxiety. There's a strong sense of there being people who have enough and people who don't have enough. So we fall back into that scarcity mentality, which says that if some people have more than their share, then some people inevitably have less than their share, and that we have to somehow fix that. That's where this anxiety comes up. It comes from our own fear of a lack, of shortage, of scarcity. And, you know, all of us build a life with what we get to be comfortable. For example, the Israelites, when they first were out in the desert, they told Moses, we want to go back to Egypt. You know, it was terrible there, but at least we knew what kind of terrible it was. This unknown is much scarier than knowing what's going to happen to us, knowing that we're going to get beaten. So that fear of the unknown is really, really strong in all of us. So when we build a life out of pieces that we feel we can kind of count on, when there's anxiety about whether we'll be able to hold that, we tend to contract and really pull into ourselves. You know, I worry, for example, about medical benefits. You know, we have Medicare. If the Medicare benefits change, I have some fear around that. I have cancer. I have no idea if I will be able to have that treated if those benefits change. So all of us have something like that, a sense of, well, I've got this, so it's mine. I'm sort of due this. And we don't want someone to take it away. See this in all sorts of settings. Even in the prison, you know, people would talk about how they had their cell arranged just right, and then they'd get a new cellmate, and everything would just fall apart. And I think, well, you know, at that point, when you're in a small cell with very few possessions, it's interesting to me that even that you feel possessive about. You feel very, in some ways, even more, because there's so little room to maneuver when that situation changes. So we build a comfortable setting and we're reluctant to see any changes in it. And that story in chapter 16 really reminds us of that. So, you know, this month we're thinking a lot about gratitude, about thankfulness. This is kind of the theme for November as Thanksgiving approaches. And we tend to think of gratitude as being thankful for having what we want, having what we need. It may be very modest, you know, and we still feel some gratitude towards a very modest set of circumstances and conditions for ourselves, for the people that we love, and hopefully at some point for people beyond our more immediate circle. There's a wonderful exercise that people do, a gratitude exercise, where every day you try to think of three new things to be grateful for. And we can all of us start out for a few days, can kind of come up with things. But then it gets a little tricky because we run out of things that we think we should be grateful for. And we have to start looking for other ways to understand gratitude. And hopefully what we do, if we persist with this exercise, is begin to understand that part of this is about, part of gratitude, the practice of gratitude, is to help us to grow our ability to accept our circumstances and to work with what we've got, whatever that might be. And not just work with it, but with a sense of joy, a sense of appreciation, at least, for what it is we have. And we don't always think of it, but to have gratitude for the things that we don't want, the things that we don't like. How do we generate genuine gratitude for those things, the things that you really don't want going on in your life? There's a great story about Shunryu Suzuki Roshi from the San Francisco Zen Center. One of the students was with him, taking him shopping for vegetables, and he was very carefully picking through the bins to get particular vegetables. And the student looked and was kind of puzzled because he was very carefully picking out things with bruises or leaves that had gotten brown or dented or, you know, even broken vegetables. And he said, Roshi, you don't have to pick those vegetables. There's a lot of really good ones in the bin. And he said, oh, I'm not worried about them, though. Somebody will pick them. I'm worried about the ones that are bruised and broken and dented and kind of on the edge, says, because people will leave them behind. And that's the kind of attitude that builds genuine gratitude, that the intrinsic value of these vegetables, that you would appreciate them. You don't want them to go to waste, even if they're bruised and broken. I love that story. Because when I was a child, we didn't have a whole lot of money. We actually had very little money. But as a result of that, the small grocery store in the town where I lived would send their culls, the produce culls, to us each week, Friday afternoon, because the store was closed Saturday and Sunday, and anything that wouldn't last till Monday morning. Mr. Freeman would put in a big box, and of course he didn't give them to us free. It just said produce, 10 cents. So every week we paid 10 cents for this box of produce culls. And my job on Friday afternoon was to go through and cut off the bad spots. And sometimes out of a peach you might get one or two good bites and the rest you had to throw out. So the fruit would get stewed and the vegetables, we'd try to figure out what to do with it. I worked with my grandmother on that. So I really love this story that Suzuki Roshi would seek out those vegetables, because it forced me to learn to cook and to be creative with food, because, you know, we might get a box of just nothing but peaches and zucchini some weeks, and that's what we had to work with. A lot of times I just grate the vegetables and throw them in pancake batter and cook those up for supper. Towards the end of the month, that was a very common supper. And I remember my ordination teacher, Genki Roshi, also talking about working with the donations that they received at the temple and learning to cook. And sometimes it would be nothing but daikon radishes. He said, it's, you know, you learn how to make an interesting meal, like fried daikon and daikon soup and all those sorts of things. You just work with what you have. So everything is relative in that way. So if we can see beyond our judgments of things, though this vegetable's not good enough, you know, how can I make it work? If we can see beyond all that, it really does allow us to tap into a very much deeper type of gratitude. So basically what it comes down to is the ability to say yes to whatever is happening, to work with it, kind of with resilience and a sense of purpose or meaning beyond that moment-to-moment what is going on. My great uncle Frank was at that branch of the family, lived in Japan, and during World War II, he had evacuated everyone but himself from Japan, and so he was taken as a prisoner of war in Japan and held in the Philippines for most of World War II at a prison camp that the Japanese set up for foreigners who were caught in Japan at the time. And he wrote a book about it, which was really interesting to read, but When I met someone who had been in the camp with him, they said, yeah, it's a good book, but, you know, there's one story that he didn't tell in it that I'm going to tell you about his time there, which was that because he was fluent in Japanese, the Japanese made him kind of a liaison between the prisoners and the army. And so he would be doing the interpreting. And they also did something that often happens in a prison or in a prison camp, where somebody who's in that position, they give them a little extra food and that sort of thing, which is a way to kind of set him apart from the other inmates. You know, it's, oh, he's a favorite of the guards, and so we don't trust him because he's got all this. But apparently Uncle Frank would save the goodies, the little bits of extra rice and whatnot that the guards would give him, and then once a week, whatever he had, he would share it with the other inmates. And in this way, he was able to kind of maintain trust with both the guards and the inmates. And this person was telling me, he's never going to tell you that that's what happened, but that is, in fact, what he did. There's a sense of abundance mentality that allowed him to do that. You have to have a sense of an abundance mentality to be able to do that, to save that up and share it with people. And it's this gratitude with an abundance mentality that leads to real generosity, not a transactional generosity, but a real, true generosity. I remember at the orphanage in Cambodia, in Phnom Penh, there was a big mango tree, Charlie will remember, in the courtyard there. And I remember seeing the kids, the orphans, climbing up in the tree and gathering the mangoes, and not keeping them for themselves, but sharing them, handing them out to everybody in the orphanage. These are kids who had nothing. I mean, they had really nothing, and yet this was just a natural activity that they did. It was, well, we came into all these mangoes, we're going to share them. They didn't hoard them. That's abundance mentality. It's actually our deepest, truest nature, if we can tap into it. There's a story that's told in Zen that I love the story, but it's an interesting one. It's about Bodhidharma when he first comes from India to China, and he meets with Emperor Wu of Liang, which is some little kingdom within China, and he's introduced as a Buddhist teacher from India that he's come to China to teach, and the emperor is very pleased to meet him because he's a very devout Buddhist. He's been for years and years building temples and commissioning Buddha statues and sutra books, having them written out and doing all kinds of good works. He was actually considered the Emperor Ashoka, who was a Buddhist emperor in India, in China. But he was doing all these good works, and when he meets Bodhidharma, the first thing he asks him, he says, you know, I've been doing all these things. I've been building temples and having statues made and all of this, and it's a lot of merit, right? I'm gathering a lot of merit by doing that. And Bodhidharma says, no, no merit whatsoever. You have no merit whatsoever. Well, he was kind of thrown by that, but he keeps asking. He said, well, if the merit isn't that important, what's your most important teaching? And Bodhidharma says, vast emptiness, nothing is holy. Well, now the emperor is getting kind of annoyed because that really didn't square with how he saw the teachings at all. And so he says, just who do you think you are anyway? And Bodhidharma says, no knowing. No knowing. There is really and truly no knowing who I am. I can't tell you. Well, the emperor didn't get any of that. None of that squared with what he knew. So he got kind of angry, and Bodhidharma took off. He thought, I better get out while I can. The emperor's not quite ready for this yet. But, you know, Westerners love that story because of the first question that the emperor asks. Look at all this merit that I've created. And Bodhidharma said, it's no merit whatsoever. As though this is not an important thing to be generous like this. And I think we misunderstand the meaning of this story if we think, oh, what he's saying is it's unimportant to do these things. More to the point is, Bodhidharma is saying, if you're keeping score about this, you're totally missing the point of creating merit, creating benefit for people. If you keep it for yourself, if you try to keep track of everything you've done and have some pride in that, you're not really being generous. You're not grateful for what you have. You're not able to be truly generous with it because you're expecting something in return, admiration, whatever, brownie points, who knows. But you're hoping to get something out of it. And so the most important thing that we can do with this merit that we build is actually to give it away. And in fact, when we chant, there's a dedication that we do after the Heart Sutra, normally on when we chant the full service. And that dedication is actually a dedication of the merit that we gain from chanting that sutra. It says we will dedicate the merit to continue the teachings. That's what we will do. Is we're not going to keep that merit, that benefit for ourselves, but we're giving it away. That's what that dedication means, is to dedicate the merit to others, whether they're teachers, fellow practitioners, whoever. So that's what that is. And for many practitioners, that gathering of merit and giving it away is their primary practice. People who bring donations to the temples, that is their primary practice. We watched in Cambodia an old woman, again, this is such a poor country, an old woman who gathered little bits of money from each of the merchants every evening, and then the next morning would hand those bills out to the young children in the neighborhood and tell them that when the monks came by begging, they were each to hand one of these bills to the monks. And so in that way she taught them how to be generous, how to gain merit from being generous. And it really struck me that it was a very small amount of money, but it created merit at each level. The shopkeepers gained merit from giving the money to the old woman. The woman gained merit from teaching the young children how to be generous. The children gained merit from giving the money to the monks. And so you come back to the question, whose money is it? It's not anyone's money. It's just being passed along. And we can truly understand generosity and gratitude in this way if we realize it's not about keeping and holding or having enough that we can give some of it away, but to really recognize that we're just passing it on. It's passing through. And it's not something that we need to think of in terms of scarcity or abundance. There's simply this act of giving and act of receiving. And this is where the generosity and the gratitude come in. So we see that gratitude really has several aspects to it, that sense of abundance. Even if there's not materially a lot, we have a sense of abundance around what we have. And when we receive something, when we express gratitude for receiving something, we receive it as an offering and not something that we are owed, that is our due to have. That there's a sense of connection and relationship. That it's not possible to give without someone to receive. It's not possible to receive without someone to give. So we're always in relationship. And then there's a sense of meaning, the higher purpose that we gain from seeing that whole network of giving and receiving. So at a time like this, when we're in these circumstances that where we're so anxious and kind of contracting, to keep this in mind and to try to come back in touch with that sense of abundance that is our deep, true nature.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.